Lots of people texting in about horns. Agree with you on this one. 100% Emil, writes Donald. This is not just Auckland. I think it's something to do with the national character. Someone else, Carol, writes, when I was in France, the definition of 1 second was when the traffic light turned green and the driver of the second car in the queue hit their horn. Yep, that checks out, Carol. That checks out, all right. GT says, my beautiful and much-missed 1966 Citroen ID had a two-stage horn, a light push let forth a friendly toot, but a harder push would produce a sound like an oncoming train. It was a superb feature, and I wish modern cars with all their other useless features would reintroduce that. That sounds like a great idea, GT. Thanks for that. It's, well, it's just after 25 to 10 here on RNZ National, and so it's time now for Midweek Media Watch. Colin Peacock is in Wellington. Kia ora to you, Colin.
Kia ora, Emil.
What do you think about the politics of tooting? You know, do you think that the first toot should be a gentle pop?
Or? Oh, definitely, because I'm a cyclist and not a car owner, so yeah. That when people use the horn to just alert, they see a friend or something, and they give it what they think is quite a casual and friendly hello there kind of toot on the horn, it can make you jump out of your skin. So I want to return to the old-fashioned, you know, klaxon, or even the kind of raspy air bulb rubber, you know,
sort of, nice, yeah. I like that, that's good. Colin Peacock, galaxy brain take, love it. All right, let's talk media. And Monday was a big day on a bunch of different levels.
Quite a surprising and unusual moment. Around 4 p.m, there were several news events unfolding at once, or perhaps more accurate to say overlapping, because some of them perhaps didn't quite unfold at the same time. So we had the Oscars, which is a big deal still after all these years. The second test was going on versus Australia. I know you don't want to talk a whole lot about that.
I don't remember any second test, Colin. I don't remember that at all. It never happened.
It happened. Face up to it. And then for political nerds, the PM's post-cabinet press conference live at 4 p.m. and covered online by all the news sites as it is these days. And then, even though we possibly didn't know it at around the 4 p.m, maybe slightly later, the LATAM plane drama. Yeah. So, I mean, I reckon, you know, there's entertainment, there's sport, there's politics, there's terror in the skies. There's something for everyone there, surely,
yeah,
isn't there?
Like it's like a great Saturday night back in the day on terrestrial television.
Yeah, well, it did make me think of Media Watch a couple of weekends ago after the News Hub announcement. You know, Warner's closing News Hub by mid-year if they get their way. We talked to a former News Hub chief, Hal Crawford, and we talked about what do you lose if you lose a news operation from a broadcaster? You know, if you still have great shows, people still might watch. And he said, no, you know, if you have a TV network that doesn't have a newsroom and it doesn't have that live news capability, you just can't reflect events in real time. And he had this good line, which I think he nicked from someone else now that he's a sort of media consultant in Australia. He said, without that kind of live, real life presence that a newsroom gives you, channels just become kind of content databases. And I think Monday, with all those things going on, even if you weren't interested in 3 out of 4 of them, you probably were in one, and you would have at least wanted to know the outcome of it.
Content databases is quite a delightful term. It sort of sounds very corporately sterile and slightly terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, well, a bit like some of those channels they actually do have at that company, Discovery, Warner Brothers, these other things called Rush and Eden and stuff like that. Mm. They have the odd good doco and odd film if you go look, but mostly they just feel like they're just playing out shows. It might as well be an on-demand platform. So that's what Hal was talking about, yeah.
Mm. That LATAM plane drama, that was crazy, wasn't it? Because the information trickled out very slowly as to what had happened.
Yeah, first when I heard, you know, just lines in text, flash news, talking about passengers getting treated because of what was described, I think, as a technical onboard issue, there might have been other forms of words around that, I just sort of thought, that seems weird, but, you know, what, 2 dozen upwards? You know, and the numbers kept going up. You think something's gone wrong there. Mentioned it to one of my kids who said, what is this poison food? Is this a norovirus outbreak or something from, you know, the dodgy chicken or beef or whatever it is? But, you know, once reporters got down to the airport and actually spoke to the passengers, then you heard those stories about, you know, people flying up into the air and, you know, blood stains on the cracked ceiling as, you know, they were thrown upwards and all of that. So great work by the reporters. And one that springs to mind was Jacob Johnson for One News. He was down there quite breathless. I think they'd just got there, got the camera, got the lights up, he had the plane over the shoulder through the window. But I mean, still at that point, really hard for reporters, not that much to say, but quite pretty. There's something pretty odd and unusual and interesting it happened, but he didn't yet have the details, but he made it come to life nonetheless, because, you know, there again, the value of a warm body, an actual journalist there, you know, telling you that something big's going on, even if we don't quite know what it is yet. But yeah, it's just some of the eyewitness accounts, you know, the passengers, they just amaze me sometimes that people can, not long after, tell you so calmly what happened.
Yeah, there is an art to a live cross, but also, yeah, exactly, the recall of people who experience something is pretty staggering. And you've got a clip, I think, of a guy who was on Morning Report the day after. Colin, what's the context around this?
Yeah, again? So this is Morning Report the next day. So I guess, I'm not sure when they interviewed him. It was recorded, things that may have been recorded the day before, but some time had passed. He had time to calm down. It was, I think, a fella from the US. His first name was Jacob, I think. I haven't got his surname. But no, he was lovely and measured. And this was his account of his experience, because he was fast asleep when it all happened.
I kind of dozed off. And the next thing I know, I was awoken, and there was just mass chaos going on around. Everyone was, they were on the floor, they were on top of each other, bags were everywhere, my shoes were several rows back.
Wow. Yeah, the granularity of the detail there.
I think he was one of those ones that later said the pilot came out and explained that the instrumentation panel had gone blank for a couple of seconds, which is really not what you want to hear, I imagine.
Americans are often just so good at telling stories, aren't they, as well?
Well, the Brits are too, because it made me think of after that that terror attack they had in 2005, I think the 7/7 terror attack, there was a horrible incident where a Brazilian guy was trying to get a tube ride for free, vaulted the barriers, and that he was shot by armed forces who were on the lookout, and it was horrible. And there was a guy there who gave the most brilliant 45-second voicer. And he was just a British citizen who absorbed a lot of news in his life. And when his time came to tell what happened, he was describing which hand the police officer had the weapon in and all of that. If you put a better shirt on him and combed his hair, you would have sworn he was the reporter. It's amazing how people can do that.
Yeah. The Oscars were also on, as you've mentioned, which is also a breaking news event in the sense that we don't know who wins. But otherwise, it's kind of like a bit of a set piece, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, also you have to really care who wins, and I kind of didn't. And I went on a BBC program as a guest on the weekend. You know, they have a couple of presenters, friends from different parts of the world, and they started asking me about the Oscars and about the Barbie snub issue and all of that, and whether the Oscars' reputation had been rescued from being tarnished by, you know, sexism and racism in the past and all that. And I just genuinely don't care who wins the Oscars. And I kind of said so out loud. I was maybe a bit of a cynic about it. And I was sort of put in my place by the other guest, who was from CNBC. She was a tech reporter. She said, oh, no, this does matter because, you know, what gets developed next is a film and people's place in it. It's a proper industry and people deserve to have the right place in it. If a certain kind of film wins the awards, that'll be the one that's financed. So if there is exclusion or prejudice going on, these things are real. So I kind of felt slightly chastened. But I was also interested, the detail did an episode about this, about how the Oscars still, in spite of all the bad PR it's had in recent years, the guilt still shines through on the statue. And they had entertainment reporter Kate Roger. She had this to say about that Barbie snub issue.
So would I want to swap out and put Greta in there for Best Director? Quite possibly. I would like to pop that in maybe instead of maybe Jonathan Glazer. But the reality is Jonathan Glazer directed a stunning film. Also, there's an argument when it comes to these awards of, look, here's a biro and here's a yellow colouring in pencil. They kind of do the same thing, but you have a totally different experience with these two things. How do you compare a film about the Holocaust and a film about Barbie and the two people that directed them?
What do you make of that, Colin?
Well, it's two things. Like, first of all, I thought she's saying it would have been better if Greta Gerwig had been substituted and Jonathan Glazer, who did The Zone of Interest, had been out of the running as a director. I'm thinking, that's crazy. Like, why on earth, if you're saying the two things can't be compared, and she's right, then why do that? But I thought that was brilliant about having the difference between a ballpoint pen and a yellow coloured pencil or something. Barbie in The Zone of Interest. It's almost, you want to go a bit more extreme, but more like some sort of Mont Blanc fountain pen and, you know, a really big bright pink crayon or something like that. But I take her point, and I think she is right in the end. But it just seems to me, it still seems absurd to compare different kind of films, say one was the best of the year. You know, The Zone of Interest and Barbie, how on earth, you know, they just don't belong in the same category at all.
Well, Colin, that's why you're not in the Academy and never will be with an attitude like that.
That's correct, but yeah.
No, I'm with you. I'm cynical about the Oscars as well. I think there's a good, and maybe the film industry more broadly, there's a good clip by, I think it's Stellan Skarsgård, talking about how there has been a massive decline in sort of mid-budget movies that cost between, you know, $5 million and $50 million. And that's where so many wonderful movies that took real risks and showed real originality, because they weren't so high stakes that they needed to be massive blockbusters, and they weren't so cheap that it didn't really matter what had happened to them. And I kind of agree with Stella on that.
That's a good
one.
Point. So you don't have to go full Oppenheimer.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, yeah, full Marvel, I guess. I think he's talking about this in the context of Marvel movies, which often cost, you know, $200, $300 million, but they made $1 billion back. So they're financially successful. But they're not really, I don't know, you don't want all movies being like that.
No, I was listening to your quiz on Monday, where you did an Oscars-themed quiz, and that kind of reminded me that even though, like you said, the Oscars are a set piece, they're not predictable, and it seems something wacky, even though I don't pay a huge amount of attention, something wacky seems to appear every. And I've forgotten about that Will Smith moment. That was only last year,
wasn't
right?
It was 2022, but it wasn't it wild? It was one of the great days on social media that day.
Yeah, and there was a similar sort of unscripted, presumably, event when the host this year, Jimmy Kimmel, read out Donald Trump's tweet that was blistering about Kimmel's own hosting, and then Kimmel responded with that kind of zinger, "Isn't it past your jail time, Donald?" And the whole crowd laughed. But it also uncomfortably reminded me of like 2016, when during the election campaign, when celebrities in the entertainment business were mocking him, and it ended up pretty much bolstering his campaign, because you had this sort of impression that elites were not on his side, and the people that did admire Trump or were prepared to vote for him, you know, the outsiders or whoever they saw themselves, were being sort of talked down to by elites in the entertainment industry. And it felt like all that from 8 years ago back again.
Yeah, there was a Saturday Night Live episode last weekend where that wider theme got thrown up again, yeah?
Yeah, Scarlett Johansson mocked. This was Joe Biden had done his State of the Nation address, and the Republicans did a rebuttal afterwards, and they got a senator from Alabama, Katie Britt, to do it. This has been pretty widely covered now. She did it in a rather odd way from a kitchen, and this was mocked afterwards by Scarlett Johansson on the Saturday Night Live show, and they did it as a kind of what they call a cold open, where you start watching Saturday Night Live, but what you think you're seeing is this mock CNN broadcast. This is how Scarlett mocked Katie Britt in that address.
Tonight, I'll be auditioning for the part of Scary Mom. And I'll be performing an original monologue called This Country is Hell. You see, I'm not just a senator. I'm a wife, a mother, and the craziest bitch in the Target parking lot. I'm worried about the future of our children, and this is why I've invited you into this strange, empty kitchen. Because Republicans wanted me to appeal to women voters, and women love kitchen. But seriously.
Okay, what do you make of that? Good satire or playing into Trump's hands?
I think it's a bit of column A and a bit of column B. So that was devastatingly good set. If you see the original, that is very close. And visually, she was made up to look exactly like Katie Britt. So that was very convincing. But yeah, again, just as we were saying there, I think it would reinforce that impression that this is just someone who's very clever with, you know, the full armory of, you know, network television and writers and so on, all trying to just do down the Republicans. So it might have that same effect.
And there were, I mean, that Katie Britt address, there were some pretty serious fake news or false claims going on in there, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. And there was a former AP journalist and author, a guy called Jonathan Katz, I think kind of turned this story over. I think the regular news media would have got to it. In her address, Katie Britt got very emotional talking about a woman who was sex trafficked at the age of 12. And this was all in the context of Biden's border policy, not keeping America secure on its southern border with Mexico. And then Jonathan Katz looked at this. He's written books and covered that issue of cartels and transborder crime and trafficking. He really knows it. So he went back, did a bit of pretty elementary internet research about when Katie Britt, the senator, would have been down on her fact-finding mission and allegedly heard the story. And it's all there, the account. It's a woman called Carla Jacinto Romero, who's turned into an activist against trafficking later. And she said out all this happened to her in Mexico, not in the US. Mm. And this was way back in the time when George Bush was president. So, you know, deeply, deeply dishonest. And yeah, Katz did a 7-minute TikTok, which is quite long for a TikTok, I think. Yeah. And it was brilliant. He didn't do it in a show-offy way. He just laid it all out there. And you just, after you saw that, you thought, well, that speech of Katie Britt's was, you know, deeply, deeply cynical. I think that was a better rebuttal in a way than the, you know, the comic Scarlett Johansson one, albeit that was devastatingly good satire as well.
Well, with an American election and a UK election coming up later this year as well, Colin, it's going to be a great year. Let's bring things back to our shores now, though, and the misfortunes befalling the TV industry. Any updates there?
Yeah, well, the Prime Minister spoke about it in his post-cabinet media conference. Inevitable, really, that he was going to get questions about that when it's still so unclear about how the government will respond or if they will respond in any meaningful way. So he was asked a few questions about that, but also what I suppose is a side issue, which is the David Seymour issue hanging over from last week. So while most people were expressing a bit of sympathy and concern about, you know, the impact on democracy, let alone the journalists who work for News Hub and TVNZ affected by these latest cuts. David Seymour was not. Said, you know, journalists were too full of self-pity and they need to innovate, be more adaptable, get with it. So some journalists felt that this was probably a breach or possibly a breach of the TVNZ Act because David Seymour, as Associate Finance Minister, is also a shareholding minister in TVNZ, and it was not appropriate, the journalists felt, for him to act in this way. And they are looking, I guess, for the Prime Minister to exert a bit of collective cabinet responsibility and authority about that. So here's part of the exchange where the Prime Minister was asked about it by News Hub's Amelia Wade.
But is it appropriate that a shareholding minister in TVNZ criticises publicly an independent editorial decision that they did?
I think he's expressing his views. As he said, he may not have expressed it the way that I would have expressed it, but the point is he's free to do so. I don't think
forbidden to do so. Under the Television New Zealand Act, he is expressly forbidden from telling them how to do any editorial decision making.
Well, again, I haven't seen his particular remarks with respect to the story that Amelia is talking about. I thought she was talking about earlier comments that he made last week. And what I'd say to you is, you know, from my point of view, those comments, he's right to express his view as he wishes, as do any other politician often does. But with respect to being the shareholding minister, what I'd say to you, I don't think he's actually contravened that at this point.
Awkward situation for the Prime Minister to be in there, Colin.
Yeah, well, it's also a bit untidy because there were a few things being raised there which were separate incidents where Seymour had made comments. But we spoke to the law professor Andrew Geddes in Media Watch in the weekend, and he's saying he doesn't think it's a breach. It's not directing the broadcaster, which was what the law says, any minister, let alone a shareholding minister in a state-owned broadcaster, they must not do that. But he says there is a pattern there of him pointing to editorial decisions he thinks were wrong, commenting in that way. And yeah, he made the point too that it was actually really up to the Prime Minister to do that. So that then for me is possibly the more significant thing, not whether Seymour broke the act or not, or quite what he's up to, but the fact that, you know, past governments, you know, I don't think the Prime Minister would have let ministers have so much leeway in a matter like this. And remember, his actual broadcasting minister, Melissa Lee, is now preparing a cabinet paper, mm-hmm. having to make policy, and it can't be helpful for her to have an associate minister with a shareholding minister in that in TVNZ, who's burning up goodwill in that way.
Anything from the Prime Minister about what the government might do to respond to this crisis in broadcast news media?
No, he just reiterated that Melissa Lee, as minister, is working on a paper to take to cabinet, which she herself hasn't said a whole lot about. But he's repeated what he said before. We don't want to bail out the media. We don't want to subsidise the media. And, you know, he repeated this line. I think some journalists probably don't like very much, which is, you know, you need to innovate. Media need to innovate, find their revenue and audience just like any other industry. But, you know, of course, they would argue media that have innovated, gone online, have had very little economic reward for it because of the way that market skews towards, you know, the huge tech operators like Google and Facebook that make the most out of it.
And speaking about that cabinet considering policy in this space, mercifully, Colin, you will be able to ask Melissa Lee about this new policy because, as you alluded to on Media Watch on Sunday, you were going to be interviewing her on the program this weekend.
I was, but I'm not now. I'm afraid not. So, yeah, was contacted on Monday to line this up to record later this week, but by the end of the day, they'd reconsidered and said, now is not actually the time with the cabinet paper. There's little she can say. She's given other broadcast interviews. So they've decided they will let us talk to her for the Media Watch program, but not now, closer to the completion of that cabinet process. It's a bit disappointing because, yeah, she has spoken to TVNZ and the AM show, News Hub, TV3 this week, and about a full 22 minutes with the platform and Sean Plunkett this morning as well. But, yeah, we're not getting a go this week. Maybe later.
Right. That's interesting. Shall we talk... Sorry, I wasn't really sure what to say to that, Colin. Yeah. I mean, it's in the name, Media Watch.
It's disappointing, let's just put it that way. But they do promise they haven't forgotten us, and maybe we'll get our turn later on to sit down with the minister and have a good old chat, because we have been trying to do this since about December when she got her feet under the table as minister. But patience, I guess, is a virtue in such things.
Right, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Should we talk quickly about the... royal family in this fake photo, or do you want to make a self-indulgent plea?
Oh, look, it's fake photo. I'll just make a quick comment on that. Yeah. Pretty bad that agencies have to issue a kill notice on a picture that's basically a home photo. But it's funny, just looking at American news reports saying the scandal dragging on to a second day. And I went and had a look just before coming on tonight, because the British newspapers are out, the morning papers for Wednesday, and I looked at, they always do this thing on Sky News and other broadcasters there where they have journalists dragged in to say what's in tomorrow's papers. So this would have been nighttime British time. There's nothing. There's nothing on the front pages of all the main... They've got a whole new crop of British political rows and scandals and some, you know, business stuff going on, the immigration policy story about puberty blockers is now blossoming up through the press and British NHS policy. So that fake photo thing just seems to have vanished. So I don't know if people were that bothered about it after all. Bit of breathing room for Princess Kate as she recovers from whatever the health problems are that have kept her out of the public eye.
The conspiracy theorists will be having a field day with that missing from the papers. But that'll be one to keep an eye on. Anyway, Colin, you wanted to make a self-indulgent plea on behalf of your community.
Well, I put this at the end of the notes thinking maybe we wouldn't get to it, and perhaps I shouldn't, but... the last time we spoke 2 weeks ago, it was actually the day before my birthday, and it's a leap year birthday. I'm a leap year person, and I'd keep that on the down low. Don't talk much about it. But the next day, I was disappointed to hear on Wallace Chapman's panel the guest Scott Campbell in the section. This is called the I've Been Thinking section. This is what he had to offer.
I've been thinking, you know, if you were born 4 years ago on this day, are you officially one or are you four? And then does that mean if you are 84 that today you turn 21? Hopefully the maths is right there. But and if so, then do we have many 21-year-old, 84-year-olds today?
Wow, man, you're blowing my mind here.
So a bit random, but you know what I mean.
No, leap year stories like this really, you're going to get me thinking on the bus home.
There you go.
Yes, it was a, don't mean to be mean, but look, that's our special day every 4 years that we get, and this kind of quite boring observation, like, oh, how does this really work? Where do these people celebrate? It's disappointing for me and my very small and very vulnerable community of leap year people.
Hey, look, Colin, when you turn 18, I'll take you out for a beer, eh?
Cheers.